ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For the first time in over 50 years, astronauts will soon fly around the moon.
They're ready to fly.
But there are real concerns about their safety.
We're playing Russian roulette.
In our series, The Challenger Legacy, we trace the history of two space shuttle disasters. And we ask, what are the lessons for today?
I'm Karl Kuschelnitsky.
And I'm Fiona Pepper. Binge all the episodes now. Just search for The Challenger Legacy on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. Now, it turns out the war is not about regime change or oil or Israel's territorial ambitions, but the return of Christ. Later in the show, I'm talking to Mikey Weinstein, founder of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, that keeps an eye on those US commanders who are telling their troops they are fighting for Christ. When the missionaries landed on Vanuatu nearly 200 years ago, they found the way the locals counted was just too complicated, so they wiped the system out. We're talking to a distinguished Australian archaeologist about the rediscovery of the lost numbers of Antium. But we get there via Bruce Shapiro, the sanest man in the United States of America, who is here to bring us up to date on Trump, war, and the prospects, however grim, for peace. Bruce, welcome back to the show.
It's always good to be here. There are people in my life who would undoubtedly disagree with your assessment of my mental state, but that's for another day.
Well, we are only talking about those Americans that we have experienced, Bruce. it's a smaller sample. Now, Bruce, short or long? The war, short or long? From 1 minute to the next, we don't know.
It's impossible to know, except, well, it's impossible to know because there is no plan. There is no plan because this was always about not a coherent set of policy goals, but a spasm of violence and an assertion of domination by Donald Trump, right? There are two ways this could go. One way, the long way, the way Donald Trump describes it sort of in every other hour alternately, is to keep going until, what is the phrase, unconditional surrender by the Iranian regime. This is a problematic phrase, and it's problematic for two reasons. One is that, of course, as we are already seeing, the Iranian regime is not Venezuela. The Iranian government is deeply embedded in all aspects of Iranian society. It has still very large levels of popular support. It has still vast weapons caches all over the country. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard has enormous influence. It's a highly organized, multi-level structure. But the other kind of troubling thing, which I think there hasn't been enough attention to, is that the last time the phrase unconditional surrender was deployed in American politics, it was 1945. And it was deployed for the unconditional surrender of first Germany and then most importantly, Japan. You do have to wonder if in Donald Trump's brain somewhere the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima is somewhere in his spectrum of possibilities. We can't take this off the table, given how much violence there was. I don't think it's likely. The other option is actually to declare victory and withdraw pretty quickly. And the pressure on Donald Trump to do that is significant, which is why he said yesterday, well, I think it's going to end soon. We're almost done. Why? Because the political disaster coming for him and his allies is moving with increasing speed. Gasoline prices are up nearly 20% at the pump in just a week, at a time when affordability and rising food prices and all sorts of other things are already on voters' minds. It's happening in the very week that Republican members of Congress were gathered in Florida to hear from their commander-in-chief ahead of the midterms, hoping to push a very different message than the war. It's coming at a week when the first polls show public support for this war at the lowest ebb of any conflict since the history of modern polling.
What are the figures that you've seen?
Well, the Reuters Ipsos poll, which is a very well-regarded poll, shows public support for the war at 27%. That is very, very low. Even the Fox poll shows 50% support. And while all that is, a lot more and is in line with the general division of American society over Trump, that is lower than the any other modern conflict at this phase. This is not a war that has popular support.
The invasion of Iraq had something like 92% backing, didn't it, in the U.S.? I mean, almost unanimous.
2001, it was the Afghanistan war had overwhelming, it was 92%, right? The first phase. The Iraq war, by the time it came along a year later, was a little less popular, but still pretty popular. It was 75, 76%, I believe. And even the, President Obama's ill-fated intervention in Libya had 47% support back in 2011.
But this is 27.
So, there is nothing.
Yeah.
Right. There is nothing this low in the history of polling.
All right, Bruce.
And that is weighing tremendously on the White House as it goes forward.
Is the fact that the White House is worried about the electoral impact of this war reassuring evidence that there will be midterm elections? I mean, are you absolutely confident that he will hold midterm elections?
Well, it's not up to the president to hold elections. We still do have a constitution, and it's important to remember that electoral law is governed by the states, not the presidency. It's not an executive branch function, right? This is not to say that this president could not cook up a national emergency that would interfere in some fashion. Much more likely is that you're going to see a national attempt to suppress voter turnout through, congressional passage of voter ID laws, through deployment of National Guard supposedly to protect the integrity of voting. Will there be attempts to interfere with voter turnout? I think that is the greater fear than cancellation of the election, right? I will say that the spectacular failure of this war to get public support, coming on top of the spectacular failure of the immigration enforcement operation in Minnesota and Chicago to get public support, and the string of every day now massive court losses in federal court for the various Trump administration policies should tell us that this administration's ability to kind of unilaterally shut elections down is closing, right? The ability, the maneuvering space for this administration is rapidly narrowing.
Trump is saying at the moment, is he not, that he will sign no legislation that comes from Congress until Congress first gives him to sign the bill that will almost end mail-in ballots, will demand ID at the ballot box, etc.
This is what he's essentially holding his own party hostage to this voter suppression strategy. It's a strategy that will almost certainly fail in Congress, not least because there are many Republicans who like mail-in ballots. You know,
they've done well from
where,
them.
For instance, there are a lot. They've done well from them. They're in districts where there are a lot of older residents who are more inclined to be conservative voters in all sorts of ways. Mail-in ballots actually help, right? So Trump's fantasy life and the false information that he has been pushing out, you know, ever since 2020 about stolen elections is beginning to collide with the reality, not just the facts of the country as a whole, but the political reality facing his own congressional allies.
But the war does seem to have helped him in this. Recently, sharp-eyed journalists discovered that notes of an interview with an accuser of Trump were missing from the papers released from the Epstein files by the Department of Justice. Now, those interviews have now been supplied and they have been published. My hunch is if they had been published 6 months ago, they would have been front page everywhere and perhaps, Bruce, I don't know whether you would agree with me, the most damaging allegations against Trump that have emerged from the Epstein papers, but they've barely been reported.
Well, first of all, full credit is due to the remarkable investigative journalist Julie Brown of the Miami Herald, who is the great Epstein Files reporter, who is the person whose eagle eye noted these missing records and who indeed has been tracking the story. And there's just, if you care about this, you follow Julie Brown, right? It is important to say, I think, that these are, it's not one interview, but four FBI interviews with someone who says that she was sexually assaulted by Trump as while being trafficked by Epstein in the 1980s. She's someone who is part of the pool of Epstein victims who settled with his estate. At the same time, it's important to say that the specific allegations of Trump, while credible enough, deemed credible enough by the FBI to support four interviews, have not been corroborated, and this particular Epstein survivor has chosen not to pursue it further. So you know, we don't know, and I do sometimes, when it comes to the Epstein files, bear in mind the words of one of my great mentors, a civil rights lawyer and writer named Frank Donner, who liked to remind me that the truth is bad enough. we already know, of course, that Trump has been found guilty of sexual violence in a New York state court. We know from Julie Brown's other reporting in the files, just in the last couple of weeks, that he had far more early guilty knowledge of Epstein's crimes than he has admitted. Whether this would have been somehow dispositive in the court of public opinion is hard to say. Trump already has survived, the kinds of massive public relations hits that would sink any other politician. It is the case, though, that the story of Trump and the Epstein files is not over. And as reporting goes on and as more documents go on, and perhaps as this or other survivors emerge with stories, it may yet come back to haunt him even further than it has.
But Bruce, this woman says that she was somewhere between 13 and 15 years old when she was trafficked to Trump by Epstein. Now, is it not the ordinary course of events that sexual assaults are rarely corroborated? They happen behind closed doors. This woman is considered credible enough, and she's done something which those of us who report these crimes are very, very familiar with. She's pulled out. She's had enough. She's not going on with it. This is a terrible allegation against Trump.
Yes, it is. And it's important not to minimize that, the sexual assault on a teenager. And it's quite specific in its detail. That said, again, you want to, you know, one does want to be careful because,
of course,
corroboration isn't only about, corroboration is not only about eyewitness testimony. As journalists like Julie Brown know very well, you can look for patterns of other information around a story. Was the place where people were, were there other stories connected
of
to
course,
it that, that
all
you know,
of those,
make it look like a credible story?
All and, of those
and,
things
and all
must
of those
be.
Deserve to be aired, right? And I think the bombshell will be if this particular Epstein survivor, who is unquestionably someone who was trafficked by Epstein, the bombshell will be if she comes forward again, or if other witnesses come forward to corroborate,
yes.
if not the most explicit details of the story, at least the general outlines. And then this will become a huge bombshell in the ongoing Trump-Epstein saga.
Regardless of warfare. Bruce, the sacking of Kristi Noem has shown us in Australia so much more about her that we didn't know. We thought she just ran ice, but she rides a horse beautifully. And, you know, she's... tell us about this, well, this the sad demise of this star member of Trump's cabinet.
Well, look, Kristi Noem, now former Homeland Security Secretary, pushed the boundaries of even Trumpian bad taste, you know, parading herself in a Rolex watch in front of a prison in El Salvador, in front of prisoners shackled. Okay, the $200 million advertising campaign featuring her on a horse in her full MAGA regalia, which, by the way, is what got her in trouble with Trump. She was not in trouble for the murders of Alex Preti and Renee Good by her officers.
Oh, it was the costumes. It was the costumes.
Right. It was... claiming that Trump had signed off on this $200 million advertising campaign, right? So she made the boss look bad. You can't do that in Trump world. And she becomes the first cabinet officer to be defenestrated in the in this next year of the Trump administration, right? I suspect she is not the last. There are others, including... including Attorney General Pam Bondi, whose handling of the Epstein files has similarly caused problems for the boss. What was quite interesting about Kristi Noem is that the signals were clearly sent to Republicans in Congress that it was open season. The other thing that did it, of course, was her affair with former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski on involving beds on Homeland Security planes, okay, on government planes. This even by Trump standards, did not go over well, particularly when she testified before Congress and refused to answer questions even from Republicans about this. And Republicans called out her murder of her own dog, and
the dog had it coming, Bruce. The dog had it coming. Didn't the dog have to be taught a lesson? I forget the details now.
Well, this was her. She trained hunting dogs, and she didn't like the way this one particular 14-month-old dog was behaving, and she shot it, according to her own account, which led Tom Tillis, Republican senator from North Carolina, to lead her on a very uncomfortable line of questioning, which he said, look, I'm a farmer, you're a farmer. You know that this dog was not at its age of maturity. You've shot a juvenile dog. Of course, Congress being upset about shooting a juvenile dog is fine, but not when juvenile human beings are being arrested and rounded up by the agency that she leads. So you have to find some disingenuousness there. But at the same time, it is actually an important lesson. The fall of Kristi Noem over the last month or so is an important lesson that there are outer limits of public outrage in the age of Trump. that the murders of Alex Preti and Rene Good and the brutality of the enforcement operations in Chicago and in Minneapolis did damage the president enough. And the levels of protest in those cities resonated enough with the American public that the White House felt inclined to retreat, not just from the policies, but from the people responsible for them. This is actually a consequential turning point.
And more, you think, to follow?
Indeed.
Well, we shall keep an eye on that. And Bruce, thank you once again for joining us on the show. Now, coming up, it's not regime change, it's about the return of Christ. Addressing their troops before battle, US military commanders have been invoking extremist Christian rhetoric about biblical end times to justify involvement in the Iran war. A group called the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, based in the United States, says it's received about 200 complaints from service members across the armed forces about the rise of Christian nationalist rhetoric in the military. Mikey Weinstein is the founder and president of the group, and he joins us now from New Mexico. Mikey, welcome to the show.
How are you doing? Your name's David?
It is indeed, David Marr.
Nice to meet you, David.
Hey, Mikey, is this the first time you've heard of reports of this kind of behavior by US commanders? Is this new for them to be preaching Christ to their troops?
No. We're in our 21st year, David, of fighting this Christian nationalism. And I'd like to do a little experiment with you, David. Do you have a pen or pencil near you, David?
I do, at all times.
I'd like you to hold it exactly 5.5 inches over your table or some horizontal surface. Would you do that for me, please?
I am doing that, and I remember what 5.5 inches looks like, yes.
David, would you drop it, please?
Yep.
David, why did it drop?
Gravity.
And that is exactly how ubiquitous fundamentalist Christian nationalism is throughout our United States military. It's been there for a very long time. Back when the IDF invaded Gaza to start their horrendous attack on the Palestinian people, we also started getting a small amount of this. We got very little last summer when Trump attacked Iran last summer, supposedly wiping out their nuclear capacity. But that all changed a week ago last Saturday. But fundamentalist Christian nationalism is inextricably intertwined into the very particulate of the technologically most lethal organization ever created by humankind. I love NPR here in America, and I love it, you know, even in Australia. But sometimes it irritates me because you guys are so damn civil. You know, I'm screaming about this. Your voices are so professional and so nice. Even the last guy that was on seems very professional. I'd love to go have a beer and pizza with him. But for Christ's sake, pun intended, you know, we're in a war right now. You know, we're in a war to try to stop Christian nationalism from taking complete control of our U.S. military. So, you know, I'm trying to break the civility thing, for Christ's sake.
Okay, I can be a lot angrier about Christian nationalism than it may seem. But, Mikey, isn't there a constitution in the United States? Doesn't it talk about the absolute separation of church and state?
David, you're absolutely correct. And, Israel, I might point out, has no constitution. But when our constitutional founding framers looked at European history, they saw that most of the bloodbaths that had occurred there, David, had been when men of the cloth had been men in political power. They looked at Cromwell in England. They looked at our Salem witch trials, and they said, not here. So we cleaved a giant chasm, a grand canyon between spiritual and temporal, church and state, because our founding framers, even 250 so years ago, were well aware of the fact that whenever an extremist aspect of any religious faith, especially extremist Christianity, becomes an alloy to that part of the state that makes war, why, David, we do not end up with little babbling brooks, streams or creeks, or little ponds or lakes, David. No. We end up with oceans and oceans of blood. And in fact, Christian nationalists are promised a 200-mile-long river, David, 4.5 feet deep, filled with nothing but the blood of those that weaponized Jesus has slaughtered at the Battle of Armageddon. So, of course, we have a separation of church and state, but that's in the First Amendment, David. I'll stop in a second. Remember, I'm an animated, passionate guy. We also have Clause 3, Article 6 in the Constitution, which you may not know about, and most Americans don't, but that states clearly we will never have a religion test for any position in the federal government. And let me tell you, if you're a sailor, soldier, marine, or airman, do you know what they're called in our U.S. Space Force, David?
What?
Guardians. If you're in any of those positions, you have a federal job, which means there cannot be any sort of a religion test for that. And yet Hegseth, you know, our womanizing, alcoholic-infused, Christian nationalist idiot, you know, who is heading up the, again, the technologically most lethal organization, you know, ever created by our species, you know, the Defense Not War Department, every month holds a Jesus praise service in the largest auditorium of the Pentagon. He's done it since last May. The last one was Tuesday, February 17th, you know, during the duty day in uniform, and has it televised throughout the Pentagon on Channel 2. So he sets a template for what he wants to see. It's a religion test. The proof solution is to be straight, white, fundamentalist Christian nationalist, David, and male. And so that's why this is so, it's not a problem, issue, or challenge. It's a national security threat to our country and, frankly, the entire world.
Okay, so what can be done about this? If you've got a commander out there in the field saying, this is the opening battle of Armageddon, and at the end of it all, we will see Christ descend from the heavens, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What can be done about it, by you or by anyone?
Let's talk about some of this. Members of the military, our clients, we have over 100,000. I'm proud to say, not from a standpoint of being an asshole, but just from necessity, we have 8 Nobel Peace Prize nominations, including one for this year. And the last 5 have come from an individual who won the Nobel Peace Prize, who's on our advisory board. You know, so members of the military can try to file an equal opportunity complaint or an inspector general complaint, but then they out themselves. And when you out yourself in the military for standing up for your religious rights or non-religious rights, you turn yourself, David, into what we call a tarantula on a wedding cake. And we both have been to lots of weddings, and tarantulas on wedding cakes, well, that doesn't bode well for either the tarantula, you know, or the wedding cake. They can also complain to their chain of command, but they're the ones usually doing the oppressing. Or they can go to chaplains or JAGs, which are military lawyers, like I was for 7 years in the Air Force. But they are not commanders. They are staff officers. If they want to file a lawsuit, they first have to exhaust their administrative remedies, which means an EO or IG complaint. Then they have to put their name all over a lawsuit. You know, nobody wants to live the way I have to live with private, you know, with a concealed carry, private bodyguards, a lot of infrared cameras, German Shepherds who are around me now that are not pets, they're elite level protection dogs. We probably get 12 to 18 fairly noxious and grotesque threats on a daily basis, including right now I've got a bounty on my head for $20,000 that came in on our website for $5,000 for each of our staff members. I was actually offended. I thought I was worth more than that. The bottom line is that what we're doing now is trying this in the court of public opinion, which includes me getting up at an incredibly early hour to speak to your wonderful audience in Sydney and all over Australia via ABC.
But are these preaching officers actually putting anybody to a test? Are they saying you can only join this unit if you are a Christian and are barracking for the return of Christ? Or is it just preaching in the hope to, you know, to rev these guys up, women as well, I suppose, to make them more enthusiastic about the task that lies ahead? That's not a test.
You have a very good question there. The truth, however, is that when your commander even suggests something, we use the term, the verb, voluntold. Remember, your military superior is not your shift manager at McDonald's or Taco Bell. They have complete control over you. In the United States military, there's a separate criminal code. For instance, having sexual intercourse with someone other than your spouse, adultery, is routinely punished as a felony. Why? Because it destroys good order, morale, discipline, unit cohesion, mission accomplishment, and the health and safety of the troops. Commanders are supposed to never talk about their politics or the particular religious views. 95% of our over 100,000 clients are Christians. Of our staff, paid and volunteer, of over 1,200, about 84% are Christians. This only has to do with time, place, and manner. David, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Do you have a driver's license?
I do.
Does that mean you can drive around Sydney whenever you want?
Yeah, well, so long as I obey the rules of the road.
Yes, but if you obey the rules of the road, can you drive?
Yep.
No, David. No, you cannot. If you are drunk, stoned, too tired, or on medication, it's time, place, and manner. So if a member of our United States military wants to proselytize, they have to be very careful about the appropriate time, place, and manner. As a commander, speaking, if you're even gently evangelizing your military subordinate, you know, get the hell out of my face, sir or ma'am, is not an option for you, because insubordination is also punished as a felony. The same way if you're ordered to go to the base dentist at 1600 hours and you don't go, that's a felony. Our U.S. Supreme Court has made it clear that the compelling governmental interest for the military and the First Amendment, freedom of speech and religion, is to make sure our military, David, is as lethal as possible. And that's, again, buttressing those six things: good order, morale, discipline, unit cohesion, mission accomplishment, David, and health and safety of the troops. So pushing some sort of apocalyptic, tortured version of Christianity on your military subordinates and trying to justify our unprovoked attack on a country like Iran that was intimidating us as much as Mickey Mouse was, is, you know, is obviously a violation of the oath every military member takes to support and defend not a radicalized, tortured view of the end times from the book of Revelation in the New Testament, but our U.S. Constitution, which you talked about at the top of this interview.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Mikey Weinstein, founder and president of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation in the United States. Mikey, you mentioned a few moments ago that your members, who I take it are the people who are complaining about Christian nationalism being inflicted on soldiers, that your members are themselves Christians. These are Christians objecting to Christianity being forced on them.
Well, we have, you know, like I mentioned, over 100,000 clients. We're not a membership organization. Yes, these are sailors, soldiers, Marines, airmen, guardians for the Space Force, Coast Guard, which is not DOD, that's the Department of Homeland Security, and the U.S. Maritime Service. We also represent, David, to the best of our estimation, about 18% of all Muslims in the U.S. military, hundreds of Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, atheists, agnostics, secularists, and humanists. We even have 12 members of the Church of the Jedi right out of Star Wars. We don't care if they worship Spider-Man. Again, it's about time, place, and manner. And the bottom line here is that we have seen what happens in history when this occurs. I'd like to tell you a very short anecdote, unless we're out of time.
No, go for it.
Okay. When we first started the foundation in the early 2000s, we've been out maybe a year. We started getting a lot of media. I don't think we had 1,000 clients back then. I got a call one day, I'll never forget it, from the Kyoto News Service out of Japan. And, you know, you may know that news service. They're like the AP, but they cover a good part of the Asian area. And they asked if they could send a reporter from Tokyo all the way to Albuquerque, New Mexico, here in the States, to interview me. I was flattered, but I was stunned. I mean, that's a lot of money, a lot of time to spend for one interview. And they said, yes. And I said, well, why? And they said, well, our journalist will explain, you know, if you allow him to come. So I did. About a week or 8 or 9 days later, this reporter comes to my home here in Albuquerque, David. Are you following me?
I'm right with you.
Okay. And he comes in, he graduated from Tokyo University, which is like their version of Harvard. He sat down, spoke beautiful English, and he said, Mike, you probably want to know what I'm doing here. And I said, yes. And he said, let me tell you what I'm doing here. In 1936, our Imperial Japanese Army invaded Manchuria. On Sunday, December 7th, 1941, David, he said to me, we bombed your Pearl Harbor. And, you know, and we did that because radicalized Shintoists took control of our Japanese Navy and Army. And we have seen, we never forgot that. And we're looking at what's happening in your country, and it scares us. And boy, I never, ever forgot that. And I do remember the second inaugural speech by President Abraham Lincoln, when he chastised both the Confederacy and the Union, their armies, for trying to invoke God, that God is on our side, because that was exacerbating horribly the loss of life and limb. And just like, remember the Nazi soldiers of World War II on their belt buckles that said, Gott mit uns, you know, God is with us. So whenever you tried, going back to your excellent question about trying to get them revved up, you don't do it this way. Our Constitution doesn't allow that. Now, if anybody has more interest in this, you can go to our website. It's like Mr. Firefighter, MRFF. Obviously, that stands for Military Religious Freedom Foundation, but MRFF.org, Spend 300 seconds there on the homepage. See what's going on. We've been at this for a very, very long time, but you have to attack it passionately. We are a militant and aggressive organization, but our militancy and aggression is always legal, ethical, and moral, and within the bounds of trying to support, as you mentioned, our U.S. Constitution.
Mikey, we've got about a minute left. Tell me, what has your foundation been able to achieve?
Well, we've been very fortunate. I think when our clients, most of the time our clients, of course, don't want us to go public. When we get an infraction, which happens all the time, we reach out two levels above the person that is being pointed out as violating the Constitution, two command levels above, and we inform them that we're watching and this needs to stop. We've got enough of a reputation now that generally scares a commander. Or it did before Trump took over on January 20th of last year. His Project 2025, that's the playbook they have, it's 1,000 pages long, is kind of like Mein Kampf was to Hitler, Project 2025 is to MAGA. And so the elimination of so many people in our federal government and in our military has occurred. So there's very few things that are left. And one of the best things we can do now is speak to America and speak to the world. And ABC is fantastic. And I'm so glad you gave us this opportunity to speak to Australia and the rest of the world.
There's a lot of religion around military efforts, though, isn't there? You know, religious commemoration of the dead, religious commemoration at a victory, religious commemoration of great military anniversaries. Do you object to those?
No, just like I don't object if David wants to drive around Sydney when he's not stone drunk, too tired, or on medication. It's all time, place, and manner. That's perfectly fine. We have untold numbers of Christian chaplains and different chaplains. And you know, again, most of our clients are Christians. It's all about the time, place, and manner. You cannot scream fire in a crowded theater, and you can't scream Jesus is coming and we're going to, we should rejoice and be euphoric with this attack on Iran, because this is serving as an accelerant or lubricant to bring weaponized Jesus back on his white horse carrying an AR-15 to begin the gigantic blood slaughter. Time, place, and manner, brother.
I've got a last question. I have to ask you this. Can you reassure us that the members of the Church of the Jedi are not in senior positions in the U.S. military?
I'd say maybe just one or two, so that you should sleep well at night.
One or two, but one or two isn't... Okay.
Come on, I'm kidding. Oh, yeah, I can assure you that of the 12 that we've got, come on, you're Australian. I know you got a great sense of humor. Crocodile Dundee, all that, right? The bottom line here is that of those 12, I think it's safe to say they're not in senior positions.
Call that a believer. They are believers. That's a reference to Crocodile Dundee, Mikey.
I know. Yeah, I get it. You call that a knife? That's a knife, yeah.
Exactly. Mikey, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Appreciate it, you guys. Good day. Bye-bye.
I've been talking to Mikey Weinstein, founder and president of the Military Religious Freedom Foundation. And now, coming up, Vanuatu's Lost Numbers. Matthew Spriggs has retired now from the ANU, where he was Professor of Archaeology for 24 years. And he lives in Vanuatu, where apart from honorary posts at the National Museum and National Library, he holds a chiefly title, Vira Ala, which means they try to stop him, but he always wins through. A couple of decades ago, Matthew made a rash promise to the people of the island of Anaitium that he would somehow rediscover their lost language of counting, erased a long time ago by Presbyterian missionaries. Well, he's done it, and Matthew joins me now from his home in Port Vila. Matthew, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, David.
Take us to the island of Anaitium.
Well, Anaitium is the southernmost inhabited island of Vanuatu, and I first went there as a PhD student when I was an archaeologist in 1978, so before independence. And I've been going back ever since. I haven't been back the last few years, but so I'm getting rather old and decrepit, but I made regular visits there over the years. And people always used to ask me, you know, do you have any information on what our number system used to be, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, because, you know, now we use mainly kind of, you know, especially numbers after three, we use like 4, 5, 6, 7, obviously from English. And I made this, as you said, rash pledge that I thought I could probably find out by looking at early records from when the missionaries first turned up. Missionaries turned up in 1848, Presbyterian missionaries. And their problem was that the Unitarian numbering system was kind of alien to them, because when you got to numbers like 6, 7, it was something like 5 and a bit more plus 1, or 5 and a bit more plus 2. And they just found it too, they're trying to teach arithmetic as well as teaching people to read and write. And they just thought it was all too difficult, threw up their hands and got the people to adopt the, you know, an English numbering system, which they largely use. The only numbers that remain from their old system is 1, 2, and 3. And some old people back in the day could remember the number 4. And I've started working with a linguist who is doing a study of Unitarians, a great guy called Professor John Lynch, who at one stage was the vice chancellor of the University of Papua New Guinea, also living in Vanuatu and working then for the University of South Pacific. And between us, we tried to find, you know, he tried to ask like old people, can you remember what the numbers were? And I went through a bunch of old, like early missionary translations of bits of the Bible, you know, 70 years and 10 and all this, looking for the original numbering system. And we had a bit of luck, but we never quite got it.
Right.
And so we came up with what we thought it must be, particularly for the numbers. We were fairly sure of the numbers 1 to 5 by the end of it, because 5 is the same as the word for hand.
Yeah, now, I wanted to pause you there, because I'm fascinated by this notion that 1 to 5 was called hand. And the numbering system you knew also then went to the feet.
Yes. So 10 would be essentially, in an Unitarian language, would be 2 hands. And then 20 would be 2 hands and 2 feet.
Now, from your work, I take it that this notion of counting on hands and feet is quite common in the Pacific.
Yes, I think it is. And often, you know, in a lot of languages in the Pacific and Southeast Asia, the word for 5 is the same as the word for hand. You know, lima is common in Indonesian, for instance. Yeah. So it is a system, and it kind of makes sense. You know, if you're not writing things down because you don't have a writing system, you know, you count on your fingers, toes, you know, that's how you get to 20 quite easily.
But beyond 20, it's starting to get complicated. I've got a measure of sympathy for the Presbyterian missionaries, but only a measure. Because, Matthew, you mentioned that some people remembered 1, 2, and 3. Or 1, 2, and 3 was widely remembered. Some people remembered 4.
Yes.
And again, from your work, this wonderful point you make that there are many lost numbering systems in the world, but people do seem still to use 1, 2, and 3. Why?
Well, the usual explanation was these are kind of the really, you know, basic numbers that everyone can easily, you know, uses all the time. And you only need these sort of larger numbers, you know, millions and billions, if you're involved in some kind of economic system where you actually have those kind of, you know, numbers in dollars or whatever it is. But I ran a really interesting study, and I must admit, I can't claim to fully understand it. But it's, as you say, it's certainly true that the lower numerals are less prone to borrowing than the higher ones. And it's always 1, 2, and 3 and sometimes 4. And I read this article that suggests this is kind of deep in human cognition. And it's to do with what part of the brain you use when you're using lower numbers as opposed to higher numbers. Now, like I said, I'm not a neurologist or something, but it's been pretty fascinating to me to find this out.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I'm talking to Matthew Spriggs about his discovery of the lost language of counting on the Vanuatu island of Unitarian. Now, Matthew, you talk to old people and your collaborator talk to old people and they could give you one, two, three, and sometimes four. Doesn't this leave you in this curious and familiar position of hoping that the people who wiped out the language recorded it before they did so, that they somehow preserved what they were destroying?
That was precisely what kind of led me into this, because when people said, we don't know what the numbers are above three or four, I thought, well, maybe when the missionaries first started, they hadn't decided to kind of get rid of the system and they might have written it down somewhere. And this missionary called John Ingalls, who was on the island from 1852 to 1870s, he actually wrote a dictionary and grammar of the Anitimese language, published it in 1882. So I had a look at that, but there's no section on numbers. We're finished. We can't do any more than that. But there was another missionary who used to visit regularly, and he had recorded what the numbers were, 1 to 10. The problem with what he recorded was it didn't make any sense. You know, he had words in there that no one on Anitium has ever heard of these words. You know, there was one was cleth and the other was retwon. And yeah, they're just not Anitimese words. So we had something that claimed to tell us what 1 to 10 was, but it didn't make any sense. And then it was only recently, I had a National Library of Australia fellowship, wonderful thing to have, last year. And as part of the research, I found a reference to a manuscript by this same missionary called John Ingalls. But this was not 1882, which is when he's dictionary and grammar came out. It was 1859, and it was a manuscript he sent to the then governor, I guess he was, of New Zealand, George Grey.
At this point, your heart rate is increasing.
Yes, it was, certainly was. And I found a reference to it, but I got on to it was in the Auckland Public Library of all places, which has Sir George Grey's collection. And so I got onto the catalogue, but I couldn't find it. Because their manuscripts, I think they're still developing a new catalogue for the manuscripts. And this was clearly, you know, a handwritten manuscript. So I wrote to the librarians who were really helpful and they said, yes, we do have, you know, this document and, you know, this is the number of it. And if you come in, you can have a look. So a friend of mine in Auckland, I persuaded him to go and have a look and happy snap the relevant pages and send them.
To get this friend of yours to do your work for you.
Yeah, indeed. Well, he's a keen young linguist, you see, so that's why.
We take advantage of the young and their keenness in libraries, yes.
Yeah, well, we have to, don't we?
We do.
It would be expensive to fly to New Zealand just to look at your 8-page manuscript. He sent it to me. And there were the numbers. And then immediately I realized why, although we had a version of it by this other missionary called George Turner, why we couldn't read it was clearly that when his book that he published in 1861 was being typeset, the typesetters couldn't read his writing. And what they put in the book as cleth is really a word eleth, which means like you add something on or, you know. And this other word, rethwan, is another kind of word, which it's nethwan, so that they were misreading his E as a C and his N as an R.
But
and
Matthew,
then with that, the whole thing made sense.
Matthew, this takes us to another familiar problem. How well can a European ear hear the language that is being spoken to them? How carefully, how accurately can they transcribe it? And then there's the whole problem of misprints. But first, there is the problem of listening.
Well, these missionaries, I mean, they were living for years on these islands. They weren't like, you know, anthropologists or, say, linguists today who might visit a place for a few weeks or a few months. You know, they lived on the island for like the two Presbyterian missionaries who were there. They spent like 20 years on the island. So they had pretty much got the language down by the end of it. It's an incredible achievement that they did. And it's still possible to read the things that they published and wrote when there aren't misprints, and people can read it today.
Yes. I mean, it's a common problem in Australia where some people moving into a new district had the ear to write down perfectly an Indigenous language. Others just made a hopeless botch of it. And we live with those botched, attempts even today. So you identified the misprints and you now have the numbering system. How far from 1 to 10 and 20.
And I think that from just some remarks the missionary at one stage made in English, not in language, that we could probably work out, have a pretty good idea of what 11 to 19 is as well. But what we've got is basically 1 to 10 and then we've got 20.
Okay, Matthew, will you please count from 1 to 10 in the language of this island?
Okay, it has changed. The language has changed a bit. So some of the pronunciations are not what they were, 150 years ago or whatever. Okay, it's Iti Ero Esej Emanuan Nijman Nijmanum Eleth et Ethi Nijmanum Eleth et Ero. That's seven we're up to now. Nijmanum Eleth et Esej, which is eight. Digmanum Eleth et Emanuan. And finally, 10. Nijman lep ijman, which means a hand and a hand. And then 20 is, let's see, I've got it here as nikmak ero im lep nethwak ero, meaning my two hands and my two feet. The pronunciation of the words may have changed a bit in the last, since the missionaries wrote it down. But that's basically the whole system that people asked me and the late John Lynch to try and find out. They were asking me in the 1970s, and then late in 2025, I managed to find the document and was able to tell people what their system used to be.
So tell us about telling them.
Yes. They have schools on the island where they kind of teach custom, traditional ways, traditional foods and things like this, and traditional ways of agriculture. And one thing they can now do is teach the kids to count in their own language.
Well done.
There's quite a few Anaitimis people in Port Vila, and one of them is a good friend of mine, Chief Yotaya. He's the chief of the Anaitimis community in Port Vila. And I told him about this, and he kind of sat there, not scratching his head exactly, but he was thinking about it for a minute. And then he just said with a smile, one of the few Anaitimis words I actually remember from my time down there, which is upni, meaning good. And then he said in Bislamar, the lingua franca of Vanuatu, you finish now, you me savvy now, something yeah, you come back, meaning that's it, we know now, we've got it back. And that was a wonderful moment.
Matthew, thanks so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you very much for having me.
I have been talking to Emeritus Professor Matthew Spriggs about the rediscovery of the words for numbers obliterated by Presbyterian missionaries all those years ago. We will remember you, Matthew, by your chiefly title, Vira Ala. They try to stop him, but he always wins through.
Thank you very much.
And that's the show. Lately, Australia's given the streaming services of the world some celebrated hits, but the funding needed to tell our stories on television is running low. On our next, we're asking why, who bears the blame, what can be done, or is the industry shrinking too fast to recover? Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.